Hello, everybody. This podcast is a part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network, and that is supported by Kinexus. Wellness, however you define it, is achievable. You don't even need to figure it all out yourself. Talk to Kinexus. They'll give you guidance, motivation, and the push you need to reach your goals. They've got you. They're your financial partner, and they know you can achieve your very best, your financial best. Prove them right. Start right at Kinexus Credit Union. They say is nothing lasts forever, then what makes love the exception? Say, why are we still in denial when we know we're not happy here? You hear those lines, and you might think that's a bitter Smashing Pumpkins track, Billy Corgan at his most depressed, or a dramatic goth pop 1980s reflection from The Cure. You might even think it fits into dark mid-19th century European poetry, or a soliloquy from a Shakespearean villain right before he commits suicide. When in fact, it comes from one of the catchiest, happiest, and most popular songs out of the 2000s. It comes from Outkast's massive 2003 hit, Hey Ya. The song is a genre-blurring collection of acoustic guitar, hand claps, dance instructions, capped with a sing-along chorus, all ingredients of what made it become one of the biggest pop songs ever. On the surface, it's silly and catchy, with a what's cooler than being cool chant off with the audience, the shake it like a Polaroid picture dance break. But when you really listen, it's about a relationship falling apart and the modern state of romance and how common divorce is. It's about a couple losing love for each other, but being afraid to break it off. Even Andre 3000, the writer of the song and singer, tells the audience exactly what he's doing, with a subtle line hidden behind the main chorus, "You don't want to hear me, you just want to dance." Some of the best songs have that way of disguising their deep dark messages through irresistible pop hooks and uplifting music. It's those songs that personify what makes music great. It can mean something different to every listener. It can be an escape from the real problems in the world, or they can make the listener feel like they're not alone with those very same problems. A story about the destruction of drug abuse and crystal meth could also be the party song of the summer in 1997 with Semi-Charmed Life by Third Eye Blind. A look into the mindset of a gun-wielding psychotic school shooter could be the simple, breezy, lay-at-the-beach track in Pumped Up Kicks by Foster the People. And a story about incest between a mother and a son could become one of the most anthemic, inspiring rallying cries for a generation. That song was the first single off the album I want to talk about in this podcast. The song is alive, and the album is one of the cornerstones of the early 90s grunge movement. It's 10 by Pearl Jam.
The stories behind some of the most famous albums in music history. It's Beyond the Beat with Jared Lennon.
It was the morning of September 13th, 1990. A 25-year-old Eddie Vedder had just finished a graveyard shift at the Chevron Petroleum Warehouse he worked. He was on his way to do what he normally did after work in the San Diego area in which he lived, surf. With the sounds and smells of the ocean, Eddie liked to wind down and forget about his day-to-day problems. But this time around, there was something on Eddie's mind he just couldn't shake. For the last 24 hours, Eddie had enthralled himself in this demo tape of instrumental music he'd been given by a friend of his, a guy by the name of Jack Irons. Irons was a former drummer of the Red Hot Chili Peppers and met Eddie at a local club playing with a different band. As a budding musician, Eddie would like to hang around the Bacchanal Club in San Diego, help bands set up their equipment, that way he could get in for free and meet these musicians he was so interested in. Eddie and Jack hit it off and became friends, playing basketball and going on hiking trips together. Jack, who had made a reputation for himself at this point, had received a demo tape featuring five instrumentals by a Seattle band so new that it had no drummer or vocalist, much less a name. "I can't join them," Jack told Eddie, "but they're looking for a singer. Let me know what you think." And so Eddie took the demo tape to his midnight shift at work and listened to the instrumentals over and over again. As the dark night gave way to the fog-riddled dawn, Eddie hit the ocean on his surfboard. His sleep deprivation came into play, and he started to become more sensitive to his emotions, to the ocean, and to a lot of issues that had been cooped up inside of him since childhood. The mixture of everything had Eddie feeling like every nerve was being exposed, and with the instrumental tracks still fresh in his mind, he started to write lyrics in his head. They were coming together as one piece, as a collective, and it was something about one song, the one with that great bridge, as Eddie would later say, that set off the inspiration. It was triggering things that he had kept long contained from his childhood. Eddie never knew his real dad. He grew up being told his stepfather he hated was his real dad, until his mother broke the news to him in his late teens. By that time, his real father had passed away, and Eddie had to deal with the confusion and anger of not being told sooner and growing up in one big secret. Not only that, but he found out that a family friend of theirs, a guy he had run into a few times over the years, was in fact his real father. Those emotions poured out of Eddie as he thought of lyrics to that song with a great bridge. It was titled Dollar Short, later to become one of Pearl Jam's defining anthems, Alive. Eddie would later look back on that morning, remembering that he didn't do a lot of surfing that day, saying he didn't catch any waves, well, except one big one. As it all started coming together, Vedder raced back to the beach apartment of his longtime girlfriend. Still wet and working from yellow post-it pads, he pulled out his four-track recorder and began to sing over three of the instrumentals. Out came these melodies and lyrics that formed a mini rock opera, shades of his favorite band, The Who, and their album Tommy. Together, the three songs told a story based on things that had happened to Eddie and also some he imagined. It was a story about incest, murder, and remorse. Everything came together really quickly, no more than 3 or 4 hours. At work, later that day, Eddie scrawled for Stone and Jeff on the tape he'd recorded over, a Merle Haggard compilation called Best of the 80s. In the process, Vedder named the three-song package Mama Son, inspired in part by a line in The Clash's song Straight to Hell. Eddie dropped the tape in the mail that Friday morning after work, addressed to Jeff in Seattle. The song Alive became a rallying cry for Gen Xers, but it was never intended as an uplifting anthem. Its inspiration came out of pain in Eddie's childhood. Eddie talked about the story of the song years later on VH1's Storytellers, saying, quote, "The guy believed to be his father while growing up was not, and hard truth number two was that the real father had passed away a few years before, as if adolescence wasn't tough enough. So when the mum relays this information of the real father's death, it leaves the kid, who's not terribly stable at this point in his development, plenty confused. And I know this because I knew the guy. Not well, but I knew him. I mean, the guy was me, but I barely knew me then. To be honest, I was barely there to be known. And so he takes all this news as a curse. Fine, you tell me these secrets I'm supposed to forgive, but I gotta figure out a way to live with this. And fine, the dad's dead, but I'm still alive, and I gotta deal with this. So it was a curse. I'm still alive." Eddie recounts that story in the first verse of Alive with the lyrics, "Son, she said, have I got a little story for you. What you thought was your daddy was nothing but a fool. While you were sitting home alone at age 13, your real daddy was dying. Sorry you didn't see him." Eddie's curse, as he puts it, became the framework of Alive, but he took the story sideways from there. He crafted a fictional story of that same kid, but whose mom develops an incestuous relationship with him. The mother is confused over her husband's death, and now the son has grown up and looks just like the father, so she wants him. She can't help herself. Eddie talked about it with Rolling Stone magazine in 1993, saying, quote, "The son is oblivious to it all. He doesn't know what the fuck is going on. He's still dealing. He's still growing up. He's still dealing with love. He's still dealing with the death of his father. All he knows is, I'm still alive. Those three words, that's totally out of burden." Now the second verse is, "Oh, she walks slowly into a young man's room. I can remember to this very day the look, the look." and I don't say anything else, and because I'm saying the look, everyone thinks it goes with on her face. It's not on her face. The look is between her legs. Where do you go with that? That's where you came from. Although Eddie never experienced the incest in real life, you can really tell how much that revelation of his father haunted him. Eddie would actually later say his real father was a family friend of theirs growing up. He'd run into him for brief moments, only to add to the later confusion. In hindsight, he'd catch a strange look on his mom's face once in a while, thinking that she was seeing Eddie's real dad in him. The second song of the three-song mini-opera would end up being Once, originally titled Egyptian Crave. Eddie wrote this one as a follow-up to Alive, but it's less along the lines of reality. It follows the story of that same boy, the boy that had to deal with the confusion and incest, whose emotional struggle has driven him to madness, to become a serial killer. He's become a sociopath, unable to feel any empathy for others. In the first verse, Eddie's lyrics depict a man unhinged with, "I admit it, what's to say? I'll relive it without pain. Backstreet lover on the side of the road. I got a bomb in my temple that is gonna explode. I got a 16-gauge buried under my clothes." The chorus lyric has the man recognize that he wasn't always this way, with, "Once upon a time, I could control myself." With Rolling Stone magazine, Eddie talked about Once being a sequel to Alive, saying, quote, "But I'm still alive. I'm the lover that's still alive. And the whole conversation about you're still alive," she said, and his doubts, "Do I deserve to be? Is that the question?" It's because he's fucked up forever. So now he doesn't know how to deal with it. So what does he do? He goes out killing people. That was Once. He becomes a serial killer. And Footsteps, the final song of the trilogy, that's when he gets executed. That's what happens. The Green River Killer. And in San Diego, there was another prostitute killer down there. Somehow, I related to that. I think that happens more than we know. It's a modern way of dealing with a bad life. Like Eddie says, the third and final song in the trilogy is Footsteps. It wasn't released on 10, but as a B-side to Jeremy in the UK. The song starts with Eddie's character blaming his mum for becoming a murderer, for which he's now paying for in prison. The lines near the end seem to answer the question of what the mum could do to help. The character is still bitter with, "And if there's something you'd like to do, oh, just let me continue to blame you." Fellow Seattle musician and friend of the band Chris Cornell would use Footsteps as inspiration for a song called Times of Trouble. It was released on the self-titled album from Pearl Jam, Chris Cornell hybrid band Temple of the Dog, actually before 10 even came out. Eddie would send the Mamasan tape containing those three songs back to Seattle, where the future members of Pearl Jam listened and were blown away by the intensity of the lyrics and of this San Diego surfer dude's voice. Ironically, 2 days later, Eddie would come across the issue of Rolling Stone magazine that included an article about the former members of this Seattle band called Mother Lovebone and their search for a new singer. Eddie put the two and two together. That demo tape was for that band with those Mother Lovebone guys. Eddie only spent 3 or 4 hours recording the vocals on what would end up being those three songs. He loved Mother Lovebone and later said, quote, "It was like, oh, fuck. Those are the Lovebone guys right there. I should have paid more attention to that tape." That tape, a dark three-song trilogy, would really be a sign of things to come. It set the framework for 10, the darkness and authenticity Eddie could add to this catchier music steeped in classic rock influences. Alive would become the most known out of the Mamasan trio and ended up becoming the first single off of Pearl Jam's 10, released July 7th, 1991, 2 months before the album's release. The song peaked at number 16 on the Billboard Mainstream Rock Tracks chart and number 18 on the Modern Rock Tracks chart. Although the album's follow-up singles would find more success on the charts, Alive brought in the initial mainstream attention to the band. The single also spent a record-breaking 61 weeks on the Billboard Bubbling Under Hot 100 Singles chart. Alive became an uplifting anthem rather than a snapshot of a tortured childhood in which Eddie originally intended. But Eddie didn't fight the misinterpretation. I think that speaks to his humility. You hear a lot about the tortured artist, upset that their painting has been misunderstood by the larger audience, or the message in their movie is way off its original intention. Eddie's not that type of artist. Yeah, he takes his lyrics and music seriously, in fact, more serious than most of his contemporaries, But there's a difference between being serious, pretentious, and arrogant, and serious, humble, and down-to-earth. Years after its release, Eddie talked about the message in the song changing for him over time, saying, quote, "Cut to years later and we're playing to larger and larger audiences, and they're responding to this chorus in a way that you never thought. Folks jumping up and down in the aisles and using their bodies to express themselves and belting it out, singing along, I'm still alive in mass. So every night when I'd look out in the sea of people reacting in their own positive interpretation, it was really incredible. The audience changed the meaning of these words. When they sing, I'm still alive, it's like they're celebrating. And here's the thing, when they changed the meaning of those words, they lifted the curse." Let's shift back to early 1990. Pearl Jam wasn't even a thought for two established Seattle rock scene veterans. In fact, it looked as if bassist Jeff Ament and guitarist Stone Gossard had already struck gold with their hard rock outfit, Mother Love Bone. They had a record deal and were labeled as the next Guns N' Roses. Jeff and Stone had formed Mother Love Bone back in 1987 after the fallout of their last band together, Green River, which, by the way, most dub as the first true grunge band. Anyway, with maybe a hint of foreshadowing years down the line, it wasn't Stone or Jeff, the true stars of Mother Love Bone, it was frontman Andy Wood, who's credited as catapulting that band to success with his larger-than-life personality and charismatic presence. It helped them become the center of a record label bidding war, and after years of touring, finally entered the studio full of optimism in January of 1989 to record their first LP. It would be titled Apple, steeped in 70s classic rock influences, but distinguished by Wood's commanding vocals. They would go on an extensive North American tour for most of 1989, but Andy's drug habit, which included the occasional dabbling of heroin, hung over the band like a dark cloud. He'd end up going to rehab after his bandmates and friends held an intervention late that year, but it wasn't enough. On March 19th, 1990, 3 days after Andy was found unconscious at his home, he was pronounced dead of a heroin overdose. It was less than a month shy of the intended release of Mother Love Bone's debut album. It was a shock that one of the most popular guys in the Seattle music scene, the bubbly and joyous singer who everyone loved, succumbed to such a dark drug addiction. For the remaining members of Mother Love Bone, it was a gut punch. They had all spent much of the 80s clawing at the rock stardom dream, recording and touring over the years, but never amounting to much success. Now, when they finally hit the record label jackpot, their bank accounts finally not empty, they get stopped dead in their tracks. And not only was the future cut short for Mother Love Bone as a band, I mean, they just couldn't replace a guy like Andy Wood as frontman, but one of their best friends has now died. Jeff and Stone lost touch for a brief moment. Jeff downshifted his life a bit, playing a few local gigs with another band, and turned to his other love, graphic arts. Stone, meanwhile, barely put down his guitar. He turned his grief into inspiration, diving back into songwriting, but moving away from the classic rock atmospherics of Love Bone and towards a more hard-edged groove. Part of the new blueprint was an instrumental track he titled Dollar Short. For help, he called on an old buddy from middle school named Mike McCready. Stone had reconnected with Mike at a house party. Stone always looked up to Mike's guitar playing, the way he could shred Hendrix licks, and the dexterity he had in his fingers. Mike would play these school gigs growing up, stealing the show with his classic rock and blues-influenced guitar solos. Mike was very much a lead and solo guitarist, while Stone was more in the rhythm and songwriting realm. They would lose touch over the years, with Mike taking the well-traveled route of trying to make it big by moving to LA with his band Shadow. By 1988, the LA experiment turned into a failure, his band returned to Seattle, and soon broke up. Bummed out over the whole experience, Mike decided he'd give up on the music dream. He cut his hair, picked up odd jobs, and started taking community college classes, barely playing guitar at all anymore. But it would be a Stevie Ray Vaughan concert that would reignite Mike's inspiration. According to Mike, Stevie Ray began the song Couldn't Stand the Weather. These huge clouds suddenly rolled overhead the crowd and began dumping rain. When the song ended, the rain stopped, and as Mike later said, it was like a religious experience, lifting him out of this negative mindset he found himself in and getting him to pick up the guitar again. As fate would have it, he'd run into Stone soon after at a house party, where Stone invited him to his parents' attic to jam. As things started to progress, Mike suggested bringing Jeff into the fold, knowing his and Stone's previous work together in Mother Love Bone. Initially, Stone wasn't into it. The ending months of Mother Love Bone as a band wasn't very positive. Even besides Andy's drug addiction, the members were spending a lot of time together, and there were some unresolved issues where the guys ended up not really trusting each other anymore. But knowing the chemistry those two had, Mike was adamant on the reunion. After agreeing to meet up for a dinner, Jeff and Stone worked out their problems and were real honest for the first time about how they felt about each other, giving each other new boundaries and guidelines. It was the catalyst on repairing their relationship, and next thing you know, Mike, Stone, and Jeff are now all jamming together in the attic of Stone's parents' house. Dollar Short, which would end up being Alive, was the first song they worked on together. It was an instrumental track Stone had written, initially intended for Mother Love Bone. Mother Love Bone would end up performing the song a handful of times, but with Andy Wood's vocal style, you can hardly tell it's the same framework for what would be Alive. Instrumentally, you can kind of hear the difference for what would be Alive compared to the rest of the songs that would end up on 10. It's still more steeped in that lighter, classic 70s rock bluesy feel. Mike even freely admits that he based his guitar solo on the one Ace freely played on the Kiss song, She. As Mike Stone and Jeff jammed in that attic, the new material they were coming up with together was darker than the music of Mother Love Bone. Maybe they were drawing some inspiration from their collective grief. The songs had more emotional resonance. Without a permanent singer or drummer on board, the three of them decided to record their instrumental demos in August of 1990, barely 5 months after Andy Wood had died. There were 8 tracks in total, all later to become Alive, Once, Footsteps, Black, Breathe, Even Flow, Animal, and Alone. Soundgarden's Matt Cameron accepted the invitation to loan his drumming skills for the recordings. During a trip to LA, Jeff and Stone would give a cassette of 5 of those songs to one of their favorite drummers, former Chili Peppers member Jack Irons. They were trying to recruit Irons, trying to get a band going around him, but he declined. As he received the tape, though, Stone made sure to mention that if Jack knew of any singers, be sure to pass the tape along. A month later, the Mama Son tape with this crazy, dark trilogy of songs arrives back in Seattle, highlighted by the raw power in this singer's voice. Jeff talked about it in Cameron Crowe's Pearl Jam book 20, saying, quote, "On first listen, I thought, wow, this is really good. I listened to it 2 more times and thought it was awesome. So I called Stone and said, I think you need to come over here and tell me for sure." Stone has the next quote in the book saying, quote, "Ed's choices were definitely different from what I would have expected. Ed's stuff is so driven by lyrics. He had to find the melody for the lyric to have an impact. I think I was used to singers that would just find the melody first and then match it with some words." Mike added his take in the book saying, quote, "I think it was fate or something. There had to be some sort of luck and timing and fate. We gave a tape to Jack Irons and he randomly knew Ed from a hike, you know? And then Ed would go surfing and put lyrics to 3 songs. There's something else in the universe happening other than it being planned out." That October, Eddie Vedder arrived in Seattle for the first time to meet Jeff, Stone, Mike, and newly acquired veteran local drummer, Dave Crewson. Eddie didn't want to mess around. He didn't want to sightsee or hang out with the boys first. He wanted to get down to business and to make the most of the 7 days he was in Seattle. I think that's part of what bonded him to the rest of the guys. They were all in a variety of bands for years up to this point. They had enough of the pissing around aspect of being in a band. Sometimes guys like the life being in a band lends itself to. The girls, the lack of responsibility, more than the art, the creativity, and the creation of music. In fact, that's why Eddie quit his old San Diego band, Bad Radio. They weren't taking it seriously enough. And so it was those 7 days, the practice space in the basement of the Galleria Potato Head in Seattle, where lightning was struck. They'd wake up, maybe grab a coffee, go to the studio, and practice. Until they got hungry, then they'd get some food, come back, and go back to the music, eat again, maybe grab a bottle of wine or two, and play some more. They were all-day affairs. Black, Oceans, and Release were among the first songs worked out together that would end up being on 10, as well as Just a Girl, Breathe, and Alone. Eddie would work on lyrics and melodies for about 5 songs, while the rest of the guys were coming up with about 4 or 5 more. The band would play Eddie something, and he'd come back the next day, all prepared with the song complete. Drummer Dave Crewson would later say, quote, "As fast as we were working on those songs, new songs were cropping up. It was the fastest, most creative thing I've ever been a part of. It was so quick, and ideas were flowing so fast. I just remember Eddie had papers laying all over the place and was constantly scratching down lyric ideas." By the end of their first week together, they had recorded 10 songs as demos. The ones that eventually made it onto 10 included Even Flow, Once, Release, Alive, Oceans, and Black, as well as a handful of improvs or unfinished ideas, including one which would turn into Yellow Ledbetter. That's 10 songs in 7 days. 10 songs that would become concert staples for them for the next 30 plus years. 10 songs and 7 days that would change their lives forever. Maybe it's playing the Monday Morning Quarterback, but it almost gets freaky when you see how many stars needed to align for Pearl Jam to become what they became. I mean, never mind just the whole Jack Irons passing on this random demo tape to Eddie thing, but I mean, Eddie being welcomed into this thriving music scene in Seattle that was just localized at the time, the scene fitting perfectly his rock ethos of honesty and authenticity. Also, the stars aligned in the way of a generation of kids who were looking for just that type of music after a decade of computerized drum machines, synths, and men wearing makeup. You look at Pearl Jam's history now, 11 albums and 30 plus years together at the time of this recording, they're a rock and roll anomaly for how proficient they've been and how they've stayed together for so long. It's amazing to me the lightning they caught in a bottle that first week Eddie came to Seattle. And so on the last day of that week, Eddie reluctantly went back to San Diego, but he had already made plans to return. After only 5 or 6 days, he comes back to Seattle, and wanting to test out the new lineup, they get their first live gig, a 1-hour slot at the Off-Rap Cafe. Needing a name to go by and remembering one of the names on the basketball trading cards they were swapping during rehearsals that week, they called themselves Mookie Blaylock, the name of a then New Jersey Nets point guard. They got the idea after someone had slipped Blaylock's card into the cover of one of their rehearsal cassettes. It was more of a goof and something quick to call themselves. They were too busy at the time with songwriting. So on October 22nd, 1990, in front of about 200 people at the Off-Ramp Cafe in Seattle, Pearl Jam, or Mookie Blaylock as they were known, played their first show. Looking back, maybe the most noticeable aspects of the show is Eddie's clear nervousness. By the way, it's up on YouTube if anyone wants to take a look. Eddie wasn't the charismatic, crazy guy jumping around the stage lead singer that we've come to know. He was reserved and stared at his shoes behind his hair most of the show. It's hard to believe now, but I guess it makes sense for a guy as down-to-earth and modest as Eddie is as a person. He was stepping in, singing in front of these guys who had been in this big Seattle band, singing in front of a crowd of all their friends. It hadn't even been a year since they lost Andy Wood, so I'm sure Eddie felt the sharpest edge of the crowd with their scorecards out on this new guy in town. But Eddie's authenticity and emotional honesty shone through right from the get-go. You'd think they'd open the show with a fast-paced, heavier song, maybe get the crowd moving a bit, get them excited. But no, Eddie was insistent on opening their very first show with a song called Release. On the outset, Release is a very odd opener for a rock show. It starts very calm and fragile, and although it's a slower song, the lyrical content is very deep. It's almost like a prayer, as Eddie reveals his yearning for the father he never got to know before he passed away. In the second chorus, he writes, "Oh dear dad, can you see me now? I am myself, like you somehow. I'll ride the wave where it takes me. I'll hold the pain, release me." It's a closure type song. It's full of empathy, understanding, and a sense of releasing any bad feelings or thoughts. It sounds as though Eddie is making an attempt to communicate to his real father and showing him what he has done and how he did it. It's honest, personal, and intense, coming from Eddie, who was 25 at the time. His delivery at first is quiet, but builds to a wall of angst as he approaches the last verse, singing, "I'll wait up in the dark for you to speak to me. I'll hold the pain, release me." The pain Eddie felt over the whole situation with his dad and stepfather was clearly eating him up at the time. I mentioned the Mama Son trilogy, that dark story of incest and murder coming to him on the surfboard. Well, release came to him all at once in a similar way. It was a complete improvisation during that first week the band got together in Seattle. It was the start of one of the rehearsals, and the guys were just tuning up and setting up for the day. All of a sudden, Stone played this simple picking riff on guitar, and then Eddie followed suit. He talked about it in an interview, saying, quote, "On release, everyone plugged in their guitars and started this kind of tinkling, and I started humming, moaning, or whatever, and then all of a sudden it was like a 6-minute song that totally rolled and peaked. Those words, I still refuse to write them down. Even if they need them for publishing, I won't write them down. That was just something I hadn't experienced. It was so intense." What emerged was basically top to bottom what would end up on 10, requiring no editing after the fact. It was so raw for Eddie, singing about the father he never knew off the cuff like that, he had to excuse himself immediately after. Jeff would find Eddie crouched down in the hallway outside the rehearsal space. Eddie would later say, quote, "I was still thinking of stuff with my dad and loss, and they're thinking about the situation with Andy and everything. We were strangers, but we were coming from a similar place, and all of that came out in the first batch of songs." Some words here and there were the only things that changed, but most of the off-the-cuff lyrics Eddie supplied the first time the band played it would still be intact on the album. In his book 20, Cameron Crowe wrote about being at that first show in Seattle, writing, quote, "The audience at the band's first show at the Off-Ramp was filled mostly with anxious and hopeful supporters. Eddie was nervous, swaying backward and forward, side to side, holding onto the mic stand like a young captain steering a pontoon ship. The songs are what stood out, confident, honest, and memorable. There was one song that towered over the rest to me. Release was a song written from way down deep, filled with open-hearted emotion. It reached people instantly. That galvanizing moment, with audience and band coming together, set the stage for all that would follow." Release would end up being the final song on 10, along with an unlisted interlude that followed the track, later to become known as Master Slave. Master Slave is an ambient instrumental piece, weaved from sparse percussion, bass, and ghostly guitar. It would bookend the album, ending it, and also opening it before the first song once. A friend of the band and lead singer of Soundgarden, Chris Cornell, was at their first show, and remembered it vividly, talking about it years later, saying, quote, "It definitely, to this day, was absolutely the best inaugural show I've ever seen in my life. Hands down, no comparison. And it has nothing to do with my perception of how great they are as a live band now. I remember exactly what I was thinking then, and it was that they were absurdly great." By December of 1990, Eddie would pack all his belongings and permanently move from San Diego to Seattle. A representative from the record company that signed Mother Love Bone had moved to a different label, Epic Records, by this time. He loved what he was hearing from the early stages of what had morphed out of Mother Love Bone and quickly snatched them up for a record deal. The record deal sort of hit home that this was getting more serious, especially as they were set to hit the studio to record their first album in a few weeks. The name Mookie Blaylock was not going to fly as a band name. They knew they needed something more serious. After signing the record deal in New York City, Jeff Stone and Eddie caught a Neil Young show at Nassau Coliseum. Neil played for 3 hours, but only really played 8 songs. He was having these long jams with his band, and the guys loved it. For some reason, they had already come up with the name Pearl, and after seeing Neil perform in that jam style of his, they threw jam at the end of it. It's the less romantic tale of how the name Pearl Jam came to be, but the true one. Throughout the 90s, Eddie liked the art of mystery and myth-making and would tell reporters that the name was inspired by his great-grandmother Pearl and a psychedelic jam she would make. This is what he said in one interview at the time. Quote, "We'd kind of been bouncing words around and Pearl came up, and then there was this thing that stems from my strange history. Great-grandpa was an Indian and totally into hallucinogenics and peyote. Great-grandmother Pearl used to make this hallucinogenic preserve that there's total stories about. We don't have the recipe, though." In fact, Eddie did have a great-grandmother, Pearl, but she was never married to a Native American. So after getting their first taste of live gigs outside of their native Seattle, opening up for their fellow Seattle scene friends in Alice in Chains for a West Coast run of shows, Pearl Jam would hit this studio in mid-March of 1991. In hindsight, in terms of the city of Seattle, it was almost like a bubble of creativity was about to burst and spread to the pop culture masses. Soundgarden was in the studio beginning work on their second album, Bad Motor Finger. Nirvana was in Los Angeles recording Nevermind. The Cameron Crowe directed movie Singles about the music scene in Seattle was moving along and being filmed. And the release of Chris Cornell's Andy Wood tribute Temple of the Dog album was imminent. Everyone around the scene seemed to feed off the buzz of creativity and possibility. Pearl Jam was certainly no exception. Everything had moved so quickly for them up to this point, hiring Eddie and Dave, recording the demos, playing the first tour and signing a deal. Getting in and out of the studio as quickly as possible just seemed par for the course. Jeff later talked about their collective headspace going into recording 10, saying, quote, "We wanted to make a record and we didn't want it to come out in like 1993. We told the record company, this is when we want to make the record and we want to be on the road this summer. That's a huge priority. And we're not going to overthink this thing. We're not going to get caught up in the game and the bullshit. We're going to make a record the way people are supposed to make records." Pearl Jam chose London Bridge Studios in Seattle to record the album. For a producer, Rick Parasher had worked with the Pearl Jam members briefly on Chris Cornell's Temple of the Dog album, so they chose him. With most of the material for the record already written, recording took less than a month. They went into the studio shooting for a raw, live feel, avoiding studio gimmickry wherever possible. With Jeff and Stone maybe conforming a bit to what the label wanted in Mother Love Bone, they went into 10 wanting a diverse album this time around. They didn't want to get pigeonholed, and that's why they fought so hard for more obscure songs like Release, Oceans, and Master Slave. Besides the diversity in music, one thing that remains quite consistent on 10 is the intensity of the lyrics. The darkness behind Eddie's raw power in his voice. As debuts go, 10 was uncommonly intimate, dragging the listener through an array of emotions. Lyric topics range from incest to murder, growing up without a father, to war and greed on Garden, suicide and Deep, to bullying and Jeremy. Eddie wore his heart on his songwriting sleeve. He was a happy-go-lucky surfer guy on the outside, but obviously was dealing with a lot of personal issues internally. He wasn't sentimental and trying to write a hit song of the summer. He basically sang about everything but love, besides the heart-wrenching Black, of course. It's obviously the authenticity people were craving in the early 90s, coming out of the hair metal scene, which had become such a parody of itself. With Warrant, Whitesnake, and Motley Crue dominating MTV in the charts, who knew it would only be a couple of years before the biggest song in the world was about a bullied school kid who shot himself in front of his classmates? So much for Girls, 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 and Cherry Pie. In an interview at the time, Eddie talked about his songwriting approach, saying, quote, "Music, for most people, it's some kind of release to talk about real life and escape through that way. That way you escape through dealing with something rather than just escaping by escaping. By talking about something that's totally not real, like dressing up in leathers and riding motorcycles and getting girls and whatever, I don't know, I'd rather talk about real life in songs. That's just me." Two songs relating to Eddie's intense lyrics lead us to what would end up being their second single off of 10, tackling the topic of homelessness, Even Flow, as well as the fourth track off 10, Why Go. Why Go is about a friend Eddie knew from Chicago who was sent to a psychiatric hospital at around the age of 13 for smoking pot. It caught Eddie's attention because he started seeing this trend mostly in suburban America, where parents were institutionalizing kids instead of dealing with the regular difficulties of raising a family on their own. Eddie talked about it in a 1991 interview, saying, quote, "When you're inside and you have no control, and when you're the 14-year-old version of Francis Farmer, you know you have reasons to be angry. You have reasons to be angry when your parents, who are very sheltered themselves, make decisions as to what you should experience in your life and what's normal and what's not. And then you've got institutions on the other side who are taking large amounts of money through insurance companies by diagnosing their children unfit for this or that." In the first verse, Eddie writes, "She scratches a letter into a wall made of stone. Maybe someday another child won't feel as alone as she does. It's been 2 years and counting since they put her in this place. She's been diagnosed by some stupid fuck and mummy agrees." This girl was put into the mental hospital by her parents. The chorus of the song reflects how the girl feels betrayed, freaks out, and fully rebels. Why go back to the people who put you in there? Why go home? Eddie viciously growling about the teenager's fight for independence. The next song I want to talk about is one that has since become one of their biggest songs, a concert staple and a fan favorite to this day. After witnessing Pearl Jam's very first show in Seattle, Kim Thayil of Soundgarden went up to Stone and told him he particularly liked this song, calling it Evening Flow. He thought it was about how the evening just sort of flows along when everyone's having a good time. Of course, the song he means is Even Flow. I talked about how smooth the recording for 10 went, how they were all buzzing off this newfound creativity and chemistry. Well, Even Flow was the one exception. The guys in the band claim that the song was attempted anywhere from 50 to 100 times, mainly due to drummer Dave Crewson's inability to nail down a consistent tempo. The engineers actually had to edit the middle of the song because Dave was speeding up too much. Like I said, it's another example of Eddie championing the downtrodden, the people who have been given the short end of the stick in society. In this case, Eddie writes it as a narration of the life of a homeless person. In the second verse, he writes, "Kneeling, looking through the paper, though he doesn't know how to read. Oh, praying, now to something that has never showed him anything. Oh, feeling, understands the weather, or that winter's on its way. Oh, ceilings, few and far between, all the legal halls of shame." The legal halls of shame, I imagine, meaning homeless shelters and prisons. At a 2018 show in Seattle, Eddie revealed that the song was inspired by a specific man he encountered when he first moved to Seattle. He mentioned hanging around the rehearsal space and meeting a homeless military veteran, ironically named Eddie, and buying him the same sandwich that he bought for himself. But for some reason, the guy wouldn't try to help himself or accept help to get out of his situation. Eddie went on to talk about coming home from a European tour and the man wasn't there. He thought he had died, but Eddie found out the man was actually living under a freeway. It was a relief, but it wasn't much later that the homeless vet did die. At that 2018 show, Eddie said his friend never knew that he was part of the next song as the band kicked into Even Flow. In the chorus, you could interpret it as Eddie's take on this homeless guy's irrationality of not accepting help. There's countless thoughts popping into this guy's head, but with the crazy experience of living on the street, he's unable to distinguish from the cracked thoughts and the rational ones, so he drives them all away. He doesn't push himself to get out of his situation. Maybe it becomes sort of like Stockholm Syndrome, maintaining that even flow of life he's grown accustomed to. Eddie writes, "Even flow, thoughts arrive like butterflies. Oh, he don't know, so he chases them away. Someday yet, he'll begin his life again. Oh, whispering hands gently lead him away." You can tell Eddie has empathy for the homeless. He doesn't look at them like scum, like crazy people, like how they get treated a lot of times in society. He looks at them as people down on their luck. And that's a common thread you see throughout Eddie's songwriting. He's shedding light on these horrible situations he has witnessed in the world. But it's not dark just for the sake of being dark. It's not a gimmick. His gift was internalizing everything he saw, but refusing to settle on just being bleak. No matter how grave the songs get, at the core, there is some small ray of triumph, never being beyond redemption. Even Flow peaked at number 3 on the Billboard Mainstream Rock Tracks chart, and number 21 on the Modern Rock Tracks chart. And as the second single off 10, even though Alive wasn't as huge as it would get to be yet, Even Flow proved Pearl Jam was more than just a one-hit wonder. It became the fifth most played song of the 90s on mainstream rock radio and is the most played song in Pearl Jam's live show to date at more than 800 times. It's the song that brought the quintessential Eddie Vedder character into the mainstream, the caricature everyone likes to sing when trying to imitate Eddie, even Adam Sandler on Saturday Night Live. When you think of Pearl Jam, you think of Eddie Vedder's band, but it's important not to forget at the time of recording 10, it was very much Stone and Jeff's band still, and Eddie knew it. Pearl Jam morphed out of Mother Love Bone. The groovy, hard-driving, and at times really catchy music came first. It's the vessel that disguises such dark lyrics throughout 10. Even Flow was a Stone Gossard song formed with Mike, Jeff, and Matt Cameron as one of the instrumental demos they laid on tape to find a singer and drummer. The riff Stone came up for the song drives the track basically from start to finish, but it's Mike's contribution on lead guitar that stands out the most. He adds these little wah-wah hints during the chorus and rips a blazing solo near the end. Mike talked about it in an interview saying, quote, That's me pretending to be Stevie Ray Vaughan and a feeble attempt at that. Stone wrote the riff and song, I think it's a detuning. I just followed him in a regular pattern. I tried to steal everything I know from Stevie Ray Vaughan and put it into that song. A blatant ripoff, a tribute ripoff, if you will. It's maybe what separates Pearl Jam from a lot of bands, and you see it all over 10. Each member has their moment to shine, affecting listeners on their instrument in the way Eddie can on his vocals. Whether it's Mike's intricate lead work, Jeff's groovy quirky bass, Stone's riff writing, or any of those weird unique fills Dave Crewson has on the drums. Besides Eddie, I'd say all these guys as individual players are super underrated. You never hear them on like the 50 greatest guitar player of all time lists or anything like that. But Eddie's raw talent and charisma quickly drew the spotlight, and whether the guys in the band liked it or not, the public perceived Pearl Jam as Eddie's band. And credit to Jeff and Stone for handing over the reins. It was hard for them after 10 was released and Eddie got all the attention in the press, when in fact Eddie wouldn't even be there if it wasn't for the rest of the guys inviting him in. It was always Eddie's band to the public, and maybe an interesting example of an outside perception influencing the reality of what the dynamics were inside the band behind closed doors. In an interview, Jeff talked about the maturity he and Stone had developed after their experiences in bands like Mother Love Bone, how they had now formed a team mentality in Pearl Jam, and that helped them get through the massive success they'd soon see. Jeff saying, quote, "All of us had been in other bands for 10 years up to that point, and so for me there was a feeling like if I'm going to do this again, it has to be all for one, one for all, or I don't want to do it. Because I had been in other situations where there's lots of egos and power struggles within the band. As you get older, I think you start to understand the power of the team element. Like as a group, it can be exponentially more powerful than as an individual. I think we all understand that." The ironic thing is that Eddie perceived himself as the newbie in Pearl Jam as well. And just as he was during Pearl Jam's first show at the Off-Ramp Cafe, he continued appearing self-effacing during their early shows and hiding behind his hair. But that quickly changed. Stone credits Soundgarden's Chris Cornell's love and support for Eddie as a main factor in giving Eddie the confidence to really embrace being himself and feeling the support out of the Seattle scene. Soundgarden was one of the first bands to make it big out of that scene and were well respected. Cornell sort of took Eddie under his wing, asking him to sing on the Andy Wood tribute Temple of the Dog album and bringing Eddie up on stage a few times to perform together. It sort of signaled to everyone in that scene that it was cool Eddie was now carrying Andy's torch as the new frontman in town. When writing and recording 10, it was fairly clear that it was a Stone and Jeff production. The proof was in the pudding for how great these songs were, but there was one track where Eddie had the confidence to take the reins in and show the other guys a song he had written both musically and lyrically. That leads us to the 8th song on 10, and the only one with a single writing credit to Eddie, it's Porch. Maybe it was foreshadowing for what would come in the Vitology and No Code eras of the band, with Eddie taking the songwriting reins. Porch was written during one of Eddie's solitary stints late at night during rehearsals for 10. It became associated with Eddie's stance on abortion after he wrote pro-choice on his arm during their performance of Porch on MTV Unplugged. Eddie also wore a shirt with a coat hanger on it while performing the song on Saturday Night Live and added the lyrics, "A woman has every right to choose, choose for herself." It's one of those Pearl Jam songs that are very much open to interpretation on its meaning, but it seems to be about having a bad time in a relationship with someone you still love and starting to think about leaving the person, aka leaving the porch, with the lyrics, "And the cross I'm bearing home ain't indicative of my place. Left the porch, hear my name. Take a good look, this could be the day." In the book 20, Eddie spoke about the song and where his songwriting headspace was at during that time, saying, quote, "There are times in your life when everything seems poetic. Sometimes everything you see drives you to explore further thought, or at least write it down. There are songs everywhere asking to be written. At that time, things like Porch just seemed to come out. My cells were vibrating." The lyrics are not what stands out on the song, though. It's the music and the fast tempo. It was a sign of things to come with Eddie already trying to push the band's music closer to punk. And then the guitar solo hits and gives the listener a bit of a breather. They slow the tempo down while Mike adds a unique touch, playing two different but similar guitar solos on top of each other. Although only 3.5 minutes on the record, The song quickly blossomed into one of the band's best concert jams, often reaching 10 minutes during their live shows. Especially early in Pearl Jam's career, the music seemed to transform Eddie into a possessed man with no inhibitions. It was during those early shows, and usually during Porch, where Eddie would make a name for himself, climbing the stage scaffolding or the wings of the theaters the band was playing, falling into the hands of an often worshipful crowd. There's countless videos on YouTube where you can see Eddie in those years, 25 feet above the stage, and the band looking up in amazement and worry. In 20, Eddie talked about the energy he was getting from playing those songs live, saying, quote, "I was channeling something different. I got to that place you hear about where the mom lifts the car off the two-year-old kid. It was that kind of adventure. At that point in life and having at long last the opportunity to play for bigger crowds, I really and truly felt like I had nothing to lose. No thoughts of what may be waiting in my future. It was all about the now." And that was part and parcel with whatever message the group and I had to impart on the audience at that instance. Risking your hide to evoke that emotion became part of the program. It's that aspect of Pearl Jam's shows that have made a name for them as one of the best live bands to see. They leave it all on the stage. In late 1991, Rolling Stone magazine asked Eddie to contribute a letter for its Year in Review issue. Eddie, about a year entrenched in the Seattle music scene and with 10 making slow but steady headway with fans, saw the writing on the wall. He was on the front lines, seeing more and more kids come out to their shows, clamoring for authenticity in their music. Eddie could see what was popular in the 80s nearing its end, writing in the magazine, quote, "Finally, music gets to the point. Ian sings, We're All Here. Perry sings, These Are the Days. Cornell sings, The Wreck Is Going Down. And he's right. Wake up or die in your sleep." When you think about it, there aren't too many examples of smaller market cities producing music scenes that reach a global scale. Like, would you say Detroit would fit that bill in the 50s and 60s with Motown? Athens, Georgia with early alternative in the 80s? Nashville's ongoing country scene? I don't know. But something was brewing in Seattle in the late 80s and early 90s. It was different from other music scenes, say in Los Angeles. It wasn't dog-eat-dog. Jonathan Poneman of Sub Pop Records has said that because Seattle was a relatively small music market, the music scene had a special quality to it. All the bands needed to support each other, saying, quote, "There were like 200 or 300 people who went to every show. It really was a scene back then. There was these bands that all went to each other's shows. They all went to each other's parties. There was a real familial, some would say incestuous quality to the whole thing. And the thing that was so amazing about the original Seattle scene, it was like conformity be damned." Seattle was mostly left to its own devices by the record companies at this time. It wasn't exploited yet. So organically came this unique style of music where everyone fed off each other's sounds. Of course, it wouldn't be long before the record companies rolled into town and sucked whatever they could out of the scene, but when Pearl Jam was writing and recording 10, the music they were making wasn't even regarded as radio-friendly. As the rep from the record company Epic, Michelle Anthony, says, no one really knew what to do with them at the time, saying, quote, "In 1991, alternative was Natalie Merchant and Depeche Mode. It wasn't what we think of alternative radio now. Pearl Jam didn't easily fit into the alternative format. Guns N' Roses was the bridge between the hair bands and the music that would come later out of Seattle. It seems incredible now to hear Pearl Jam and Nirvana as not fitting in a rock format, but a lot of those stations were still playing Warrant and classic rock. We were literally caught between formats for a good 9 months." Pearl Jam really had a unique quality to their sound on 10. Their songs were all mostly dark and were far from what was mainstream sonically and musically when they released the album in 1991. On the song Garden, Eddie writes about modern urban society and what her priorities and needs have transformed into. I think Eddie was unknowingly representing his generation in Garden, speaking for people his age who were disenchanted by the consumer culture of the 80s they grew up in. And I think that's why grunge took off as much as it did. It was a reaction to the greed and hypocrisy they'd been force-fed by corporate America. Eddie spoke about the inspiration for the lyrics in a 1991 interview. And by the way, when he says Chris, it's Chris Cornell, saying, quote, "I remember sitting in this pool hall with Stone and Chris, and we watched this really old, really classic pool hall. And we were sitting there, and it was really rainy out, and George Bush came on and started telling us about the Gulf War and that we were going and the whole thing. And there's a part of that in it when we talk about, I don't question our existence, I just question our modern needs. Why were we doing this? And why were we going off? Garden is dark in tone, but it has a hint of optimism, of being uplifting and empowering for that generation who felt so bogged down by society at that time. The Gulf War in Iraq sparked that feeling for Eddie, and you hear it in the chorus, his frustration of walking into the society they inherited as young adults, the Garden of Stone, but not backing down from their morals and not giving in. He writes in the chorus, I will walk with my hands bound. I will walk with my face blood. I will walk with my shadow flag into your garden, Garden of Stone. Stone has said that Garden is probably his favorite song off the album because of its simplicity and its arrangement. It came together from a verse and chorus Stone had written, and the bridge evolved from a jam with Jeff. Although never confirmed by any band member, the phrase Garden of Stone likely came from a 1987 movie, Garden of Stone, about the Vietnam War. Moving to Deep, the 10th track on the record, it's brutish, sucking you in with a low-key first verse, giving way to controlled chaos for much of the rest of the song. It shows the versatility of the band, crafting a heavy-duty rock and roll song, but also with a great groove. The story in this one is much more obvious. It's about a drug addict sitting on his windowsill, looking down at a society that has rejected him because of his habit. In fact, it was inspired by a story Jeff had told Eddie about walking down a Seattle street with a beautiful view of the city, only to look up at an abandoned apartment building and see a man shooting heroin. In an interview, Eddie had this to say, quote, I think about why people need those other things in their lives to keep them happy or keep them going. I guess I was kind of addressing that in the song. Deep starts out with the lyrics, on the edge, a windowsill, ponders his maker, ponders his will. To the street below, he just ain't nothing, but he's got a great view, and he sinks the needle deep, can't touch the bottom, in too deep, can't touch the bottom. And then moving to Oceans, you hear this very unique chill track with softly ringing guitars and soaring vocals, imparting a relaxed vibe, very dreamlike. At track number 7, it's a nice breather after 5 very intense, dark and heavy songs. It was an example of how quickly Eddie was coming up with lyrics on the spur of the moment, coming from an instance where Eddie was locked outside the rehearsal space during a rainstorm. Someone had asked him to put change in the parking meter outside for them, and he turned back only to find himself unable to get back into the building. Eddie recalled the memory in an interview, saying, quote, I had a scrap of paper and a pen in my pocket, and they were playing this song. All I could hear was the bass coming through the wall, this window that was boarded up. So I wrote the song to the bass. I wasn't even listening to hear the song at first. When I heard a break, I'd start pounding on the door, trying to get out of the rain. So as I was doing that, I thought, fuck it, I might as well write something. Eddie has said that's why the vocal melody matches with the bass perfectly. It was all he could hear. So locked out in the cold and rainy Seattle climate, Eddie decided to write about the biggest love of his life at that time, surfing. It's the shortest song on 10 at 2 minutes and 42 seconds, with only 2 verses, no real choruses or hooks or anything. Kind of an off choice for a single and video, their 4th and final single off of 10, released at the end of 1992. In the first verse, Eddie writes, Hold on to the thread, the currents will shift. Glide me towards you, know something's left. And we're allowed to dream of the next time we touch. Following Pearl Jam's performance of the song at the band's 1992 MTV Unplugged performance, Eddie said, quote, That's a little love song I wrote about my surfboard. No, actually, it's to somebody named Beth, who hopefully I'll see tomorrow. Another thing that stands out in Oceans is the unusual percussion. Dave Crewson has said that they originally tracked a regular drum kit for it, but once they added the timpani parts with the drums muted, they liked the uniqueness of the sound. Oceans was only initially released as a single outside the US, finally hitting the American market as a single almost 4 years after it was recorded in June of 1995. They filmed a black and white video of the band in Hawaii, but again, only released it outside the US because by the end of 1992, they felt the band had gotten too big. During the spring of 1991, just ahead of the recording session for 10, Eddie was in Seattle and reading his newspaper one morning. A shocking headline appeared in front of him and caught his attention about a teenage suicide in Richardson, Texas. The story was about a 15-year-old boy who had arrived late to his second period English class one day when his teacher told him to go down to the office and get an attendance slip. Instead, Jeremy Dell returned with a .357 revolver, and before he killed himself in front of his classmates, he turned to his teacher and said, "Miss, I got what I really went for." The thing that grabbed Eddie's attention that morning was that he'd had a Jeremy in his life too. Eddie was in 7th grade when a kid he knew brought a sawed-off shotgun to class. The kid shot up a fish tank, and luckily the teachers were able to get the gun away from him before he hurt anybody. But what shocked Eddie was the look in this kid's eyes. They were soulless and black, like a shark. And what ran through Eddie's mind was the fact he'd gotten into a fight with this kid about a year earlier. Eddie, sensitive to all his emotions at this time and riding this crazy creative high ever since joining Pearl Jam months earlier, got out his pen and pad and, off of just one article, wrote about this suicide out of Richardson, Texas, later naming the song after the boy who did it, Jeremy. Only drawing from a small paragraph of the facts of the story, Eddie imagined the life of a troubled youth, excluded and ridiculed by those around him. In the first lines, Eddie paints an image of a lonely kid daydreaming at home, but his internal pain, ignored by his parents, drives those thoughts into something sinister. Writing, "At home, drawn pictures of mountain tops with him on top, lemon yellow sun, arms raised in a V, and the dead lay in pools of maroon below. Daddy didn't give attention, oh, to the fact that mummy didn't care. King Jeremy the Wicked, oh, ruled his world." In the second verse, Eddie switches gears and draws from his own experiences with a quote-unquote Jeremy in his life, the kid he had bullied. Eddie paints these vivid images of how the bullying drove this kid insane, finishing off the paragraph with the analogy of the pain of getting your jaw punched having the same effect on hearing about this kid bringing a gun to school. He writes, "Clearly I remember picking on the boy. Seemed a harmless little fuck. Oh, but we unleashed a lion. Gnashed his teeth and bit the recess lady's breast. How could I forget? And he hit me with a surprise left. My jaw left hurting. Oh, dropped wide open. Just like the day I heard." And of course, the immortalized line in the chorus, "Jeremy spoke in class today." Eddie imagined this Jeremy kid as a real introvert, real quiet, and known for acting sad. By speaking in class, obviously, Eddie meaning when he stood in front of his classmates and shot himself. The real mother of Jeremy in the song has since come out in public and spoke about her son, saying that the day he died did not define his life. He was a son, brother, nephew, cousin, and a grandson. He was a friend, and he was talented. Of course, Pearl Jam never intended the song to get as huge as it did and have people misinterpret the meaning and their intention. But it was another example of Eddie championing the disenfranchised, another tale of desperation and alienation. When asked about the song years later, Eddie had this to say. Quote, "It came from a small paragraph in a paper, which means you kill yourself and you make a big old sacrifice and try to get your revenge. And that's all you're going to end up with is a paragraph in a newspaper. 64 degrees and cloudy in a suburban neighborhood. That's the beginning of the video, and that's the same thing in the end. It does nothing. Nothing changes. The world goes on, and you're gone. The best revenge is to live on and prove yourself. Be stronger than those people, and then you can come back. That's kind of what I did." Eddie wasn't exploiting Jeremy's death with the song. He was bringing awareness to children killing themselves and asking the question why. Interestingly, Jeremy almost didn't make the final cut on 10 just because the guys thought it wasn't the album's most inventive track musically. Jeff had written the music on acoustic guitar with the idea of writing something for a 12-string bass he had just ordered at the time. In the studio, they overdubbed the bass with the new 12-string bass that had finally come in, but they also decided to add in a haunting cello over top. There was one day where Stone didn't make it into the studio because he was sick, and Jeff, along with Eddie and their producer Rick Parasher, came up with the art piece that opens and closes the song on the 12-string bass. You hear those first two notes of the song and you know exactly what you're listening to. I guess a testament to Jeff and an example of how Pearl Jam were able to create hooks on their songs besides just Eddie's voice. It was those additions, along with the added background vocals and very strong lyrics from Eddie, that convinced the band to leave the song on the album. When people now think of the song Jeremy, they likely also think of the video, which basically was on repeat on MTV during its height and launched Pearl Jam into superstardom. The video wasn't made until almost a full year after 10 was released. By that time, Pearl Jam saw a slow and steady build to their success, but nothing quite insane yet. They hired Mark Pellington to direct the video, depicting the story of the song where this kid is bullied and feeling alienated before finally speaking in class, as the song says, shooting himself in front of his classmates. The impact and success of Jeremy immensely shaped the band to what they are today. Its success was so massive and the attention it garnered so extreme that the video was the last the band would make until Do the Evolution in 1998. They thought the videos took on a world of their own, detracting away from the music. In 1993, interestingly 2 years after the album's release, the Jeremy video won 4 MTV Video Music Awards. In accepting the Video of the Year trophy, Eddie Vedder said, quote, "If it weren't for music, I think I would have shot myself in front of the classroom. It really is what kept me alive. So this is kind of full circle. So, to the power of music, thanks." Pearl Jam was thrust into an unwanted limelight they were unaccustomed to and unprepared for. When you think of a song that ushered in the grunge era, you think it Smells Like Teen Spirit. But the yin to that yang is easily Jeremy. For a lot of people, it was an introduction to this band with a thoughtful message, authentic, and pissed off at the hypocrisy and injustice they see in the world. But they weren't ready for the spotlight, especially Eddie. As the album continued to sell and climb the charts in 1992, Eddie spoke about the unintended consequences of having a hit album and the criticisms that come with it, saying, quote, "It can be a scary thing to sell that many records, because then people start being cynical with you now you're some kind of big thing, and they don't open up to you in the same way. I think that a band is a small foreign film. It's not a blockbuster American movie. It's not Terminator 2. I never wanted it to be. So I don't want people thinking we are or talking about us like we are, or saying, you gotta listen to this record, it's the greatest thing, you gotta listen to this record. Because it's much more subtle. You have to kind of open yourself up to it and maybe listen to it on headphones and then start hearing what's really happening and hearing some of the emotions on there. Anytime you get cynical with art or emotion, in a way, you start censoring it, you start not believing it." Let's skip ahead now to 1993. Eddie was a mess trying to cope with this newfound spotlight of being told he was this voice of a generation. Wearing his heart on his sleeve throughout the lyrics in 10, not thinking many people would hear it, and then having people criticize them, pick and prod, and judge him because of it. Eddie was now clamoring for some sense of normalcy. To get away from everything, he liked to embrace the outdoors. He would not only surf, but escape on camping trips, on multi-day hikes, anything to connect with nature, something that was always there for him. It was one night during this time where Eddie was not only escaping the spotlight, but was also coping with grief. His friend, guitarist Stephanie Sargent of the band 7 Year Bitch, had passed away. Eddie was mourning that loss while out sitting on a deserted coastal sand bluff, what he thought was well away from society, never mind the circus that had become life as a band member in Pearl Jam. As Eddie looked out on the ocean and contemplated life, strange voices came from the hill behind him. They started to get louder and oddly more familiar. The puzzled look on Eddie's face soon gave way to a heavy sigh as he recognized that the voices were singing a Pearl Jam song. It was the Fragile song that would soon symbolize the over-commercialization of the band. It was Black. By 1993, the former happy-go-lucky surfer, always smiling, quiet, and shy Eddie, was hardly recognizable. Success didn't bring Pearl Jam happiness, especially Eddie, and so the line was drawn at Black. The record companies and the corporate side of Pearl Jam were begging for another single and saw the dollar signs in their eyes with this ballad about heartbreak. But Eddie drew the line in the sand. No video was to be made for Black, and the band backed him up on that decision. But even the author couldn't steer the Pearl Jam ship into obscurity after Jeremy's success. A song like Black was just too good to ignore. The sight of Eddie angrily telling those surprised hikers to stop singing his song out near the ocean that one day was a metaphor for that period in his life. The members of Pearl Jam just couldn't get away. It was a struggle. Eddie talked about the song Black during that period in their career, saying, quote, "Some songs just aren't meant to be played between hit number 2 and hit number 3. You start doing those things, you'll crush it. That's not why we wrote songs. We didn't write to make hits. But those Fragile songs get crushed by the business. I don't want to be a part of it. I don't think the band wants to be a part of it." In hindsight, you can see why it was an easy decision for Eddie to not want to exploit Black. It's so vulnerable for Eddie, so gut-wrenching, honest, and personal. As Jeff would later say, it's a song that's all about the emotion it comes from. You feel it in Eddie's incredible vocal performance. And they must have seen what happened in the response to the Jeremy video and were afraid Black's emotional weight would be destroyed in video form. Black started off as one of those instrumental demos Stone recorded on that tape they were passing around, this one titled E-Ballad. Eddie didn't initially record over top of it, only sending back his contribution with a Mama Son trio. It wouldn't be until Eddie was traveling to Seattle to go meet the guys, where he'd write Black on the way up. For the lyrics, Eddie wrote about a first love and the demise of the relationship. Eddie stated in 20 that, quote, "It's a true story, something that I really felt and I still feel every time I sing it." It's speculated that the woman the song is based off of is Liz Gumbel, Eddie's girlfriend in his junior year of high school, someone he had a deep and romantic relationship with. When they broke up, Eddie was sad, plus there wasn't a lot of structure in Eddie's life at the time, beginning with a move to Chicago and the early forms of destructive family relationships. He spoke about it in the book 20, saying, quote, "The song is about letting go. It's very rare for a relationship to withstand the Earth's gravitational pull and where it's going to take people and how they're going to grow. I've heard it said that you can't really have a true love unless it was a love unrequited. It's a harsh one, because in your truest one is the one you can't have forever." It's hard to find lyrics to songs that stand on their own, lyrics that sound good without music the way poetry can. That's not necessarily what music is about anyway. It's a collective of everything. But that's what makes Black such a great song. When you read the lyrics by itself, it sounds really good. It evokes emotion. And it's only amplified by the music added in later. That's where the beauty of how Eddie writes lyrics comes in. He's not trying to write lyrics to a melody or to a piece of music. He's writing lyrics that stand on their own. A much harder process when it comes to combining the lyrics to the music, especially when Eddie's not writing most of the music at this point. But that's the beauty in a song like Black. And another factor, the lyrics aren't complicated. They're easy to understand. It's authentic and doesn't ooze any pretentiousness that can come when musicians sometimes try too hard at writing poetry in their lyrics. The first verse starts with, "Sheets of empty canvas, untouched sheets of clay, were laid spread out before me as her body once did. All five horizons revolved around her soul as the earth to the sun. Now the air I tasted and breathed has taken a turn." And that's where the song takes a darker turn, with Eddie singing about the nostalgia he has for that first love and how much of himself he put into a now failed relationship. "And all I taught her was everything. I know she gave me all that she wore. And now my bitter hands chafe beneath the clouds of what was everything. Oh, the pictures have all been washed in black, tattooed everything." In the second verse, he paints such a vivid picture of how much pain he's in. He's now becoming angry at anyone he sees as happy, even innocent children. "I take a walk outside. I'm surrounded by some kids at play. I can feel their laughter, so why do I see her? And twisted thoughts that spin round my head. I'm spinning, oh, I'm spinning. How quick the sun can drop away." Like I said, the lyrics are so much more effective through the brilliance of Eddie's vocal performance as he's getting more emotional as the song progresses. It's capped by probably the deepest lyric in the song, maybe the deepest on the whole record. "I know someday you'll have a beautiful life. I know you'll be a star in somebody else's sky. But why can't it be? Can it be mine?" In the end, the main character still wishes the other person the best and to be special and unique in someone's life, but he's still devastated by his loss. It's an example of a maturity and a level of self-awareness you don't see often in characters in heartbreak stories. He's trying his hardest to rise above his emotional state. In March of 1992, Pearl Jam had just returned to North America after their first European tour to tape an episode of MTV's hugely popular Unplugged series. It would end up being another milestone and benchmark for why they became as popular as they did, highlighted with a heart-wrenching performance of Black. There was a particular unforgettable moment at the end of the song during the big outro where Eddie added the lyrics, "We belong together, together." It was simple. A guy sitting on a stool ripping his heart out, drowning emotionally. And it connected to millions of people. Their unplugged performance as a whole showed the world why Pearl Jam would stand the test of time. Their talent and emotion transcended studio magic to a stripped-down version of songs that were never meant to be played on acoustic guitars. After Unplugged, letters to the band's 10 Club almost doubled, many were about black, and they began in an eerily similar fashion. I was recently considering suicide, and then I heard your music. Years after Black's release, Eddie changed that edition in the end to We Didn't Belong Together, Together, as if he's now had closure and realizes that the relationship needed to take the course it did. Musically, it's a rare Pearl Jam song rooted quite obviously in the blues. Stone wrote a musical piece that was simple, it didn't have a lot of chord changes or parts. In 20, Jeff wrote about that period of time, writing music for what would be 10, not long after him and Stone were still mourning over their old singer's death, Andy Wood, and how it almost seemed like fate as Eddie came into the fold with all this authenticity and honesty in his songwriting. Jeff saying, quote, "I just felt like I could really relate to what he was singing about and how I felt a real camaraderie with him that I'd really never felt since the first band I was in. He was somebody who I trusted wholeheartedly. It almost didn't seem real at the time. I was so excited to play with him. With things like Black and Release, I don't think he'd ever put those feelings into words before, and we certainly hadn't been involved in anything that had put those sort of things into words. We were feeling the same things, coming to grips with death, loss, loneliness, and all that stuff, and really starting to understand it. Everybody was pretty raw at that point. Luckily, Stone had been picking up his guitar and channeling that hurt into songs." By the way, see if you can hear the similarities in the intros of Black to another classic heart-wrenching ballad about loss, Pink Floyd's Wish You Were Here. The guys in the band did all they could to prevent Black from being a hit, but at the end of the day, it was just too good of a song. Eddie even personally called radio station managers to make sure Epic had not released the song as a single against his wishes. In spite of this, the song charted at number 3 on the Billboard Mainstream Rock Tracks chart and number 20 on the Modern Rock Tracks chart in 1993. 10 would eventually be considered alongside Nirvana's Nevermind as the dawn of the grunge movement. 10 was released in August of 1991, 1 month before Nevermind, and while it took a year for the album to really reach audiences, 10 became a huge hit. By May 30th, 1992, the album would reach number 8 on the Billboard 200 chart in the US. Alive, Even Flow, and Jeremy all charted as hit singles, and Even Flow and Jeremy proved to be pop culture phenomena. 10 would continue to sell well throughout the early 90s. It would eventually peak on the Billboard 200 at number 2 for 4 weeks, only held off the top spot by Billy Ray Cyrus. 10 spent a total of 261 weeks on the Billboard charts, making it one of the top 15 charting albums ever. And by February of 1993, American sales surpassed those of Nirvana's Nevermind. To date, 10 has sold more than 13 million copies and remains Pearl Jam's most successful studio album even as the band continues to tour the globe and release new music as one of America's most popular rock bands. The songs moved people. They showed them a new style of commitment that had been increasingly absent in rock. They were able to toe that line between offering an escape from the real problems in the world and making the listener feel like they're not alone with those very same problems. Of getting a generation of kids singing a rallying cry about incest, "Oh, I'm still alive." As Eddie would later say, it was kind of a bummer all these songs about dark life issues were so relatable. But when you sell that many copies of a record, you know you've touched on something special. You've connected with an untold amount of people. 10 is filled with themes of alienation and rebellion, but with the message that there's always a way to find hope in the darkness. While the lyrics touch on a variety of important topics, the music on 10 is groundbreaking. It combines the excitement of classic arena rock, the what-the-fuck attitude of punk, high-speed psychedelic guitar virtuosity, and Vedder's truly distinct vocals to create an absolute powerhouse of a listening experience. Soon after 10 was released, Eddie explained in an interview the method to his rock and roll credo, saying, quote, "People listen to music for different reasons. Some people, it's background music, but other people need it to survive. Other people need music to get things out, and maybe that's just where I'm coming from. You know, when things weren't easy for me growing up, you know, music, I felt, saved my life. This was a young band, barely together for a year, yet confident enough in style and aware of their strengths to release a cohesive debut album that would indicate their potential. Hell, Yellow Ledbetter was a B-side. To date, Pearl Jam has never really stopped making music. As Cameron Crowe writes in 20, they've grown from earnest young musicians with hearts on their sleeves to unjaded and barely prepared travelers through the portal of enormous success, to unashamed participants in the politics of the world, to what they are now, musical survivors with passion unscathed. Drummers may have come and gone, but it's difficult to think of another band that has consistently stayed as true to itself and its music as Pearl Jam has done. 10 marked the beginning of a career with overflowing potential, one that Pearl Jam would not let go to waste. They've released 11 albums in total, selling over 85 million copies worldwide, and were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in their first year of eligibility in 2017. Eddie is credited communication and an understanding of each other as the reason why they've outlasted their contemporaries. He said this in 2010, quote, "When you get married, you don't want to get married after 2 dates or 3 dates or whatever, especially to 4 other people. But we got in that relationship pretty quick, and we appreciate that these relationships are what keep the music going and the songs coming. That's more important than anything." Guys, thanks for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with everything I got going on with this channel, be sure to follow my Instagram page. Also, I do have a YouTube channel where I condense individual stories from my podcast into short video form. So please like and subscribe on there as well. Thanks again.